We are in 2 Samuel chapter 1 tonight. Tonight we begin brand new book of the Bible, 2 Samuel. And as I said in that little video preview, if you were here this weekend when Charlie Campbell was teaching and Pastor Rob and I were both out of town, I let you know that not only are we going to look at 2 Samuel, but something kind of unique we're going to be doing over the next month and a half here on Wednesday nights as we look at 2 Samuel is we're going to be looking at the same time at the book of 1 Chronicles. Now, understand why we're kind of looking at these side by side. They cover the same exact time period. The same exact time period, the same story that is told in 2 Samuel is covered in 1 Chronicles, but it's covered in a different perspective. 2 Samuel was written by prophets. We kind of dealt with this when we started the book of Samuel. 1 and 2 Samuel are really one book in the Hebrew. They made them two into English because it takes less time to teach through, anyways. But the reality is it's one book. And the Jewish Talmud, the original commentary on the Old Testament, says that Samuel, the prophet that started out this book, he wrote the first 24 chapters until his death in chapter 25. Then the rest of the book was written by the school of the prophets that he had started. These are men that were there with David. They were there with Saul. They were there in the trenches. Men like Nathan, who will confront David on his sin. Men like Gad, that was David's prophet as he was being chased by Saul in the wilderness. These guys are the authors of this book. And so understand, it's written from the perspective of the prophets, written in the trenches, written at the time the events occurred. Now, 1 and 2 Chronicles, same story, but a completely different perspective. Chronicles was written by priests. That same Jewish Talmud, which is again the original commentary on the Old Testament, says that Ezra the priest, the guy that was with Nehemiah in the books of Nehemiah and Ezra, that he wrote the book of Chronicles, 1 and 2 Chronicles. It was written then, that means years later, from the perspective of history. Some other difference is it doesn't major on the failings, whereas we're going to see firsthand in a couple of weeks David's fall with Bathsheba and his murder of Uriah. Chronicles just pretends like that doesn't even happen. And similar things when it comes to Solomon as well and his failings, and understand again why. 1 and 2 Samuel are written by prophets. So all the gory details are included. David's sin, Solomon's sin in 1 Kings, all the details are there. The prophets want us to see the effects of sin in people's lives. Why? So we'll turn from sin. They're speaking for God. We want you to turn for your sin. 1 and 2 Chronicles is written by a priest. And so there's a major concern about who you are in a genealogy kind of sense. The priest had to be from the tribe of Levi, and so they were big into genealogies. That explains why when you look at 1 Chronicles, the first 9 chapters reads like the Jewish phone book. It's like a list of names over and over and over again. But there's a reason for that. It's because Ezra's wanting you to know who David was, where he came from, what his lineage was, and many others who lived in Israel at that time. Again, I said 1 Chronicles, the sins of the leaders are skipped over. Not because Ezra didn't care about sin or didn't know about sin. I just think it shows us the other side of the heart of God. God's heart on one side is what? Just like the prophets. Sin's going to cost you. Run from it. Turn from it. There's another side of God, and that's that. He has separated your sins as far as what? The east is from the west. And when we get to eternity, those things will be gone. So these two different books, 2 Samuel, 1 Chronicles, cover the same story from a different perspective. And what we're going to do is we're going to look at 2 Samuel like we always do, chapter by chapter, verse by verse. But when 1 Chronicles adds something to the story, a little different perspective, a little more detail that 1 Samuel doesn't cover, well, we'll mention it here on Wednesday night and we'll include it in that study guide that you got on the way in. So study guides are back and important. You can see on the back side of the study guide there, we have the differences between 1 Chronicles and 2 Samuel, the comparisons. And then down at the bottom, we have the reading. So if you want to be an astute student and read ahead for next week. We're going to cover chapters 5 through 10, but the parallel passages in Chronicles is chapters 11 through 19. And though there isn't a lot of detail added tonight's study, next week there's a lot of things that Ezra adds to the story that is just important as we go through. So, back to our study tonight of 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel divides really into three parts for you note takers. I like to kind of give an outline to every book because it helps me, I don't know if it helps you, but it helps me kind of remember the content of the book. Whereas 1 Samuel is about how many people? Three. Oh, see, this is why we do this. Three, right. It tells you the story of who? First Samuel, that's right, first seven chapters. Then King Saul, very good. And then King David. I know there's not a slide, so you're not cheating. You're learning. That's awesome. That's what 1 Samuel is about. Well, 2 Samuel is also about three different things. The first 10 chapters are about the rise of David's throne. The first four chapters cover 7.5 years where David is really just king over Judah. He's not king over the entire nation of Israel. And we'll talk more about that tonight. Just the tribe of Judah. But then in chapter 5, he becomes king over the entire nation. And chapters 5 through 10 cover about 15 years of David's life from age 37 to 50. And it's the golden age of the Davidic kingdom, David's kingdom. And we'll look at that great stories on this weekend and next Wednesday night as well. But then we get to chapter 11 and we get to the reduction of David's kingdom. And what do you think it is that reduces David's throne? Sin. It's his sin with Bathsheba and the cover-up where he kills Uriah. And that one sin, it has ramifications in his family, we'll look at, ramifications in his kingdom because, well, sin always does cost us. But then the third part of the book, there in chapter 21, after years of painful effects of his sin, David's kingdom gets back on track and he finishes well. And so we have the restoration of David's throne, the end part of 2 Samuel. And then we'll look at a chunk one Wednesday night out of Chronicles where it sees that David just sets the stage for his son Solomon to build the temple. And so we'll see that he gets right back on track. But tonight, we're looking at the first part of the rise of David's throne. The first four chapters cover 7.5 years where David is not king over all of Israel. That'll come next week in chapter 5. He is going to become king of one tribe tonight, the king of Judah. And again, for you note takers, we're going to look at four events that happen in that 7.5 year period of time, four events that just set David up for being king over the entire nation of Israel. So there they are on the screen in front of you. We're going to see that David learns of Saul's death. David becomes king over Judah. He has to deal with Abner's rebellion. And finally, his enemies are put down and the door is open for him to become king. So let's look at those one at a time, starting tonight with David learning about Saul's death. Look with me, if you would, in chapter 1. It says, "Now it came to pass after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, and David had stayed 2 days in Ziklag, on the third day, behold, it happened that a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dust on his head. And so it was when he came to David that he fell to the ground and prostrated himself. And David said to him, 'Where have you come from?' And so he said, 'I've escaped from the camp of Israel.' And David said to him, 'How did the matter go? Please tell me.' And he answered, 'The people have fled from the battle, and many of the people have fallen and are dead, and Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead also.' And David said to the young man who told him, 'How do you know that Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead?' And the young man said," glad you asked. That's not what he said, but that's what he's thinking. We'll get to that in a second. "The young man said, who told him, 'Well, as I happened by chance to be on Mount Gilboa, there was Saul lean on his spear. And indeed, the chariots and the horsemen followed hard after him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called to me. And I answered, 'Here I am.' And he said to me, 'Who are you?' And so I answered him, 'I'm an Amalekite.' And he said to me again, 'Please stand over me and kill me, for anguish has come upon me, but my life still remains in me.' So I stood over him and killed him because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown that was on his head and the bracelet that was on his arm, and I've brought them here to my Lord." Therefore, David took hold of his own clothes and did what? Tore them. So did all the men who were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and for Jonathan his son and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel because they had fallen by the sword. And David said to the young man who told him, "Where are you from?" And he answered, "I'm the son of an alien, an Amalekite." So David said to him, "How was it that you are not afraid to put forth your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" And David called one of his young men and said, "Go near and execute him." And he struck him so that he died. And David said to him, "Your blood is on your own head, for your own mouth has testified against you, saying, 'I have killed the Lord's anointed.'" Okay, it's been a week, but remember the context of what's just happened. Remember, 2 Samuel is just a continuation of 1 Samuel. It's one book, really, in the Hebrew Bible, telling a continuous story. And what happened last week, if you don't remember 7 days ago, I have trouble with that too, so it's okay. But last week, David, while Saul was being killed on Mount Gilboa, David comes home to his city of Ziklag, and remember, he finds it burned with fire. He finds that his wives and the wives and his children of his families and his friends, all of them, they've been taken, and he doesn't know if they're just kidnapped or if they're dead. And David pursues these people that would dare to burn down his city. And he recovers all. He recovers his wives. He recovers the kids. He recovers everything. And as he's coming back to Ziklag, he's exhausted from battle, and so he's there a couple of days. And on the third day, it says a man shows up and says, "You got to hear the news, Dave. You got to hear the news. Saul is dead. Jonathan is dead." And David asked the man, "How do you know that's true?" You see, David's been a leader long enough. He knows not to just trust anyone's word. So he says, "How do you know?" And this man begins to tell the story of how he just so happened to be walking through a battle zone. Just so happened. And then he stumbled on King Saul. And Saul was there fallen on his sword, but not yet dead. And he asked this Amalekite to kill him. Now, some scholars say, well, that seems to contradict what we just read last week in chapter 31 of 1 Samuel, where we're told that Saul was injured. He didn't want the Philistines to torture him, so he asked his armor bearer to kill him, and the armor bearer wouldn't do it, so Saul fell on his own sword and took his life. But here this Amalekite who's telling us a completely different story. So what's going on? Some Bible scholars think that this Amalekite's lying, that he's just lying to get in good with David. He thinks David's going to reward him for killing his enemy, but David doesn't seem to think he's lying. Personally, I don't think the two stories are contradictory. I think they're complementary. Saul, I think it went like this. Saul didn't want to be tortured, so he fell on his sword. The armor bearer did the same and killed himself, but Saul wasn't quite dead. You know, I found this statistic that would make you think twice about suicide. 80% of suicides are unsuccessful. People are maimed, horribly injured, in a great deal of pain, but not dead. And apparently, this is what happened to Saul. Then along comes the Amalekite, and he finishes the job and brings David Saul's crown and Saul's armband. And David says, "Who are you? Who are you?" And the man answers, "I am an Amalekite." Church, these guys are everywhere. They're everywhere. I mean, think, maybe you've forgotten, but think through with me if you would. What was the people group that just burned David's city and carried off his wives, his kids, and all of his men, wives, and kids? What people group was that? The Amalekites, right. And what were they doing before that? What people group was raiding the cities of Judah and the cities of the Philistines while those two countries were at battle? It was the Amalekites. The Amalekites, who was apparently plundering the bodies after the battle. Again, it's the Amalekites. These guys are no good, and they cause pain everywhere they go. Notice that, church family. Don't go to sleep on me. Notice that, because God asked King Saul way back in chapter 15 of 1 Samuel. He said, "Saul, you got to do something for me. You have got to eradicate this world of these Amalekites." And they go into battle against the nation. And did Saul obey? No. He kept the best of the sheep and apparently the best of the people. He just thought, well, I know better. Lord, that's just kind of an unreasonable request. I know better. Oh God, that seems out of little character for you to order an extermination of a whole people group. I know better. So I'm going to do my own thing. Dumb. And I point that out to you because, man, we think along similar lines. But friends, listen, God knew. He knew what these people would do, the horrible pain they would cause, and he was trying to protect the world. And I mention that to you because the Amalekites in the scriptures are always a picture of the flesh. Do you hear me on that? They're always a picture of our flesh. Because God tells you and me, just like he told Saul back in 1 Samuel 15, to do what? To put to death the deeds of the flesh. Do you hear me on that? It's clear in the word. God doesn't say to tolerate your flesh. He doesn't say to pet your flesh. Oh, good little fuzzy flesh. That's not what he says to do. He says to kill it, to put to death the deeds of the flesh. And what do? We say, oh, Lord, come on. What's wrong with you, God? It seems a little out of character to you. Don't you want me to have joy? Don't you want me to have excitement? I've been around for 37 years, so let me give you a little benefit of my insight. Ridiculous, but that's what we do. Listen, no, God's not out of character. If that relationship or activity or venture was going to bring you joy, don't you know God would be into it? He's a father that loves you. I love things that bring my kids joy. I don't want to rob them of joy. I love it when they're happy. I love it when they're blessed. And I'm a sinful dad. Sometimes I like to pin them to the ground and hurt them a little bit. But the reality is God, not in a mean way, in case you work for this anyways, but the reality is I love my kids. God is perfect. He loves to bless you. He loves to bring things into your life that blesses you. And he also knows what will bring pain. And so, like with Saul, he says, you got to get rid of that. You got to crucify that. And listen to me, precious church family. Wise is the man or woman that says, amen. Lord, I will obey. I read this the other morning. I'm going through the Psalms in my morning quiet time at night. I read the one-year Bible, so I know what to talk to my family about because they do that in the morning. But in the morning, I'm just reading through the book of Psalms right now. I just listen to this from Psalm 112. David writes, praise the Lord. Blessed is the man who fears the Lord, who delights greatly in his commandments. You hear that? Who just delights. Lord, I love obeying you. I love doing what you want me to do. Why is that? Well, he goes on to tell you, his descendants will be mighty on the earth. The generation of the upright will be blessed. Wealth and riches will be in his house, and his righteousness will endure forever. Do you hear what David says? He says, God just loves people that say, I love to do what you want me to do. I realize it's not a bummer. It's not a roadblock. It's a road to blessing to obey your will. And it always is. This Amalekite who should have been done away with generations before, he's still around, still causing pain, as is so often our flesh. Well, this Amalekite, he rehearses the story in front of David, and he no doubt thinks David's going to reward him. David's going to say to him, oh, so glad you killed my enemy. But he obviously doesn't know David. And when in verse 11, David rips his clothes, which is that, you know, Middle Eastern sign of mourning, they rip their clothes. I bet this guy started to get nervous, don't you think? You know, he's expecting a completely different reaction. And here's David weeping, ripping his clothes. And if he was slow and didn't get it yet, what David said in verse 14 would really have got him. How were you not afraid to touch the Lord's anointed? How that Amalekite must have thought, uh-oh, this is going way different than I expected. And David does not reward this man. He has this man executed. And he weeps for Saul. And he weeps for Jonathan. And church, please note that. David's reaction to the death of his greatest enemy challenges me to my core. Remember what David's world has been like for the last 15 years. I mean, we're not talking about 15 days. or 15 weeks. The last 15 years of David's life, the last 10, he's had to live in a cave. Couldn't even have a home most of the time because Saul, when he should have been being king and leading the nation of Israel and building up the nation, what is he doing? He's chasing David around the wilderness endlessly. He took his wife away from him, Michal. He did so many things to him. And the years before weren't much better. For 5 years, when David was in good with the king and he served in his household as his worship leader in general, Saul's always throwing spears at his head. I mean, it was a nightmare hanging out with King Saul for the last 15 years. I know that if I was David, there would be a little temptation to respond exactly the way the Amalekite was hoping he would respond. Patting him on the back and saying, you're the man. Thank you. Thank you for dealing with that guy in my life. That's what I hope I wouldn't do, but I think I would. And I look at David and I say, Lord, build that heart into me. Because listen, church family, David here is a lot like Jesus, who said this in Matthew 5, verse should be up on the screen. You've heard it was said, you shall love your neighbors and hate your enemies. But I say to you, Jesus says, different commandment. I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you. Pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. And then he says that's a reason word. Why? That you may be the sons of your Father in heaven, for he makes his sun rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the just and the unjust alike. David says, you know what God's like? And he makes the sun rise on those that hate him. He sends rain to refresh those that want no heart for him. He is just good, 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 hoping people will turn and repent. And Jesus says, when you and I begin to behave like that, we start to be a lot like our Jesus. Solomon, who no doubt picked this up from his dad, he wrote this in Proverbs 24:17. Do not rejoice when your enemy falls, and do not let your heart be glad when he stumbles, lest the Lord see it and it displease him, and he turn away his wrath from him. Friends, please understand, we are never told by God to rejoice when evil befalls your enemy. Instead, what are we to do? We're to pray for them. We're to bless them. We're to be altogether different than them. And when I see David doing this, I get a little insight again to why God calls him, listen, a man after his own heart. You see, we know that David is called that. And that troubles some people. Maybe it troubles some of you. Because you know what's coming. You know that two Wednesday nights from now, we're going to read of David's darkest moment where he commits adultery and then he's not done. He's going to kill the girl's husband to cover it up and just wickedness, wickedness, wickedness. And we know the story. We're familiar with that story. And so then we read David's a man after God's heart. And we're like, how? How is that possible at all? He's an adulterer. He's a murderer. But listen, I think the mistake we often make is we compare our weaknesses with David's weaknesses. So we say, well, I've never committed adultery. I've never killed anyone. I guess I'm all right. But have you ever compared your strengths with David's strengths? How long has it been since you defeated a giant or leapt over a wall or wrote a psalm or loved your enemies? You see, I think we come about it the wrong way. And David here in chapter 1 shows a great Christ-likeness when he mourns over the death of Saul. God help us to mature when our enemies falter. David mourns, and the rest of chapter 1, we won't read it. I'll leave it for you to read on your own. He writes the greatest eulogy in all of the scriptures. It is beautiful. It is sincere. It is meaningful. It is deep. And he writes it, remember, about this man that has been nothing but a thorn in his side for 15 years. That's a eulogy. You know the word eulogy means to speak well of? I just mention that because it seems like we're losing that in our culture. Sometimes I go to funerals and I hear the meanest stuff said about people from the stage in their funeral. Men and women, eulogy means to speak well of. Speak speak, if you can't speak well, don't speak at the funeral. Keep it to your, that's not the moment to air out your family laundry. I don't know. I've been noticing that a little bit recently. And so just as a one who loves you, I share with you eulogy to speak well of David. David's a great example of that. But before we get to chapter two, one last thing. In verse 26, I want to draw your attention to this. David, speaking of Jonathan, says, "Your love to me was wonderful, surpassing the love of women." That's what David says about Jonathan. Now, maybe you've not been confronted with this yet, and so you're happy being ignorant. But some use this verse to teach that David and Jonathan had a homosexual relationship. That is a really big accepted idea in liberal Christianity. And it's based mainly on this verse right here. "Jonathan, your love for me was greater than the love of women." In reality, please understand that is a total misunderstanding of what David is saying. Well, then what is David saying? What David is saying, it's clear in the Hebrew, is the love of women is usually different than the love of men. Can we agree on that tonight? I know I'm painting with a broad brush, but women's love is a little bit more selfless. Think about it, for their kids, for their man, for their husband. If a woman's love was based on being earned, we would all be in a lot of trouble. Because at one time, we were all loved by a mama, and we did nothing to earn that love early on in the relationship. This is what David is truly expressing. He is saying the love of women is selfless. It's not looking for something in return. It's not trying to get something like male love so often is, sadly to say. It's just selfless. And he says, "Jonathan, your love for me was even deeper and more extreme than that." That's what David is saying, that Jonathan's love was selfless, beyond what you normally would experience in human relations. It's not saying anything about how Jonathan and David would hang out. So just tuck that away for when that comes up. Hopefully it never does. In chapter 2, though, we see the second event, and that is David becomes king over Judah. Look at the first few verses with me of chapter 2. Now it happened after this that David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go up to any of the cities of Judah?" And the Lord said to him, "Go up." And David said, "Where shall I go up?" And he said, "To Hebron." So David went up there, and his two wives also, Ahinoam and the Jezreelitess, and Abigail, the widow of Nabal, the Carmelite. And David brought up the men who were with him, every man with his household, and they dwelt in the cities of Hebron. In fact, the one thing that First Chronicles adds a little bit, if you want to look at chapter 12, I think it is, 12, it gives kind of a detail in First Chronicles chapter 12 of who's David's mighty men were, who they were, what their character was like. And so Chronicles adds a little bit to that verse right there in the chapters that they include. But look at verse 4 of 2 Samuel. "Then the men of Judah came, and they anointed David king over the house of Judah. And they told David, saying, 'The men of Jabesh-Gilead were the ones who buried Saul.' And David sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead and said to them, 'You are blessed of the Lord, for you have shown this kindness to your Lord, to Saul, and have buried him. And now may the Lord show kindness and truth to you, and I also will repay you this kindness because you have done this thing. Now therefore, let your hands be strengthened and be valiant, for your master Saul is dead, and also the house of Judah has anointed me king over them.'" Saul's dead. And David knows, please understand, David knows God has anointed him as the next king of Israel. But what David does next really impresses me. He prays. He goes to the Lord and says, "God, what should I do? Where should I go? To what city should I go and set up my base of leadership? Lord, what do you want me to do next?" We'll get to this more next week in chapter 5, because there's even a greater example of that in chapter 5. But I right now am being personally really challenged by David's prayer life. For I know I would be tempted to say, "Oh Lord, thank you for getting me to this day. I've been waiting for 15 years to have the job that you've anointed me to do. Now, Lord, I got it. I've been planning for this day for 15 years. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I'll check in with you if I need anything else." I mean, that's would be, You can shake your head at me like, oh, you're such a sinner, but I know you're just the same. I know you are. That's the normal reaction. Lord, I've been thinking about this, strategizing about this. Lord, I got this. That's not David. That's not David. He prays. I'll never forget when Pastor Charlie Campbell, the guy that did the sermon last Sunday morning, when he was my college pastor, he said to us, he said, prayerlessness is confidence in your own ability to get things done. Think that one through for a second. Prayerlessness is confidence and pride in my own ability to get things done. Why? Because God says clearly in his word, Jesus said this. He said this in John 15, apart from me, you can do what? Nothing. Nothing. Now, why is it that we think that Jesus was exaggerating? Do you think Jesus exaggerated? Do you think Jesus was not telling the truth? Of course not. Jesus is telling it like it is. You, apart from him, can do nothing. Zero. Zilch. But there's a part of us, an evil, sinful part of us, that says, well, I know Jesus says that, but that's not really true. I can do fill in the blank. Yet David, as much of a man of flaws as he was a man of many strengths, and one of them is he seeks the Lord. Lord, what do you want me to do? Where do you want me to go? And God sends him to Hebron. Now understand, Hebron was a very significant city, both strategically and historically. Strategically, it was right in the middle of the tribe of Judah on a hill that overlooked the surrounding country. In fact, it's still on a hill because the city hasn't moved. In fact, go to the first picture there. You can see now the modern city of Hebron is built there onto a hillside. But the view from Hebron, which will be the next slide that hopefully you can see the all surrounding country around the city. It's a great vantage point, a great city militarily to defend. But not only was it significant strategically, but it also had a great history. For some of you remember, Hebron was the home of Abraham, the patriarch of Israel. So David is saying something, or really God in his wisdom is saying something by moving David to the city of Hebron. And the men of Judah, they get it. They get the message loud and clear. They come to him and anoint him as their king, the king of their tribe. And that's the way it's going to be for the next 7.5 years. The first official act of David as king over Judah is he encourages the men of Jabesh-Gilead. Now, you got to understand why David's doing this. Remember, it was the men of Jabesh-Gilead that when Saul was taken by the Philistines and his body was no doubt mutilated, abused, all kinds of things they would have done to the king of their enemies. The men of Jabesh-Gilead, when that body was nailed there to a city wall, they snuck down into that city. And the men of Jabesh-Gilead took that body down at risk to their own lives and brought Saul back to Israeli territory and buried him, burned him and buried him to cover all the torture he had gone through and buried him there in Israeli soil. Now, David, listen. David encourages the men of Jabesh-Gilead. You guys were awesome for doing that. Why is David doing this? Some commentators make it seem that David's trying to do a political move here. You know, hey, they've anointed me king of Judah, so you guys are from the north, and I think you're awesome. Don't you think I'm awesome too? David wasn't shallow like that. That wasn't what David was doing. David understood something because he worked for the man for 5 years. Saul, King Saul, very petty, very petty. And King Saul, listen, King Saul would have seen what the men of Jabesh-Gilead did to his rival. He would have seen it as an act of war against him. He would have taken it personally. And because that's been the status quo for 38 years under Saul, David is sharing with them, that's not how the heart is anymore. I am proud of you guys for taking care of your king. I'm not going to be petty like Saul before me. And the first thing he does is he starts to turn the hearts of Israel back to him. David is behaving very wise and, again, very much like Jesus. They would have made him king, I believe, a lot sooner if not for the events that start in verse 8. Abner, who remember was Saul's general, man, he starts this rebellion against the house of David. Look at it, chapter 2, verse 8. But Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, took Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him to Mahanaim. And he made him king over Gilead and over the Asherites and in Jezreel and Ephraim and Benjamin, over all of Israel. And Ishbosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel, and he reigned 2 years. Only the house of Judah followed David. And at that time, David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah, was 7 years and 6 months. Abner, who we'll see in chapter 3, he knows David is supposed to be king. It's clear. It's clear that he knows. But he rebels against the house of David and against the Lord. But why? Why? Well, one reason is because he's family to Saul. We learned in 1 Samuel that Abner was Saul's cousin. So if your cousin has the most important job in the land, that's good for your family too. And so there's family connections there. If he would just go over to David's side, that'd make it kind of tough at Christmas, wouldn't it? You know, what did you do to our family? Or Passover, I guess they didn't celebrate Christmas. But anyways, secondly, Abner's job is also in jeopardy. Not only is there a family problem, but his job is in jeopardy because Abner was Israel's general. David already had a general by the name of Joab. So his job is in question. So Abner's not just protecting his family, he's protecting his own job. So he starts fighting against David. But as he does, notice what happens. Notice what happens to Abner. Verse 12. Now Abner, the son of Ner, and the servants of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David went out to meet them by the pool of Gibeon. And they sat down, one on one side of the pool, and the other on the other side of the pool. And they weren't going for a swim. What were they doing there? Verse 14, then Abner said to Joab, let the young men now rise and compete before us. And Joab said, let them arise. And so they arose and went over by number, 12 from Benjamin, followers of Ishbosheth, son of Saul, and 12 from the servants of David. And each one grasped his opponent by the head and thrust his sword in the opponent's side. So they fell down together. Therefore, that place was called the Field of Sharp Swords, which is in Gibeon. Now there was a very fierce battle that day, and Abner, the men of Israel, were beaten before the servants of David. And the three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab and Abishai and Ashiel. And Ashiel was as fleet of foot as a wild gazelle. He was a burner. He was like Usain Bolt. Anyways, so Asahel pursued Abner, and his going did not turn to the right or to the left from following Abner. And Abner looked behind him, being kind of an older, kind of probably a little fat guy. And he said, are you Asahel? And he answered, I am. And Abner said, turn aside from your right hand or your left and lay hold of one of your young men and take his armor for yourself. But Asahel would not turn aside from following him. So Abner said again to Asahel, turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? How then can I face your brother Joab? However, he refused to turn aside. Therefore, Abner struck him in the stomach with a blunt end of the spear. So the spear came out his back, and he fell down there dead on the spot. No kidding. So it was that as many as came to that place, Asahel fell down and died. It stood still. And Joab and Abishai also pursued Abner. And the sun was going down when they came to the hill of Ammah, which is before Gilah, by the road of the wilderness of Gibeon. And the children of Benjamin gathered together behind Abner and became a unit and took their stand on a hill. And Abner called to Joab and said, shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know the end will be bitter than the latter end? How will it be then until tell your people to turn from pursuing their brethren? And Joab said, as God lives, unless you had spoken, surely then by morning all the people would have given up pursuing their brethren. So Joab blew the trumpet, and all the people stood still and did not pursue Israel anymore, nor did they fight anymore. And Abner and his men went out on the night through the plain and crossed over the Jordan and went through to all Bithron and came to Mahanaim. And Joab returned from pursuing Abner. And when he had gathered all the people together, they were missing of David's servant 19 men and Asahel. But the servants of David had struck down of Benjamin and Abner's men 360 men who died. And they took up Asahel and buried him in his father's tomb, which was in Bethlehem. And Joab and his men went all night, and they came to Hebron at daybreak. The first thing that starts happening to Abner is he starts experiencing losses. Understand what he's thinking. He's Israel's general. He's the leader of the army of Israel. He's got to think, I'm going to go down and crush this guy, David. He's just got one tribe behind him. He's just got a few hundred men behind him. I'm going to crush this guy. And what happens? The exact opposite. He starts losing men. He starts doing things he doesn't want to do, killing people. He doesn't really want to kill. Abner, for the first time, is experiencing deep losses. Then in chapter 3, not only is he experiencing deep losses, but he starts experiencing moral lapses. Look with me in chapter 3, verse 6. Kind of gives you a little history of David and all his wives and his kids. And we'll talk more about that more next week, why David did that. But anyways, verse 6. So it was, back to Abner. So it was, verse 6 of chapter 3, there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David. And Abner was strengthening his hold on the house of Saul. And Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And so Ishbosheth said to Abner, why have you gone in to my father's concubine? Listen, we can read that and go, oh, what's the big deal? It was a huge deal in ancient Israel, in ancient Middle East. To go into a dead king's concubines, those were like his sort of wives. It was saying, I'm glad the king is dead. I'm glad he's not around anymore. And remember, Abner was fiercely loyal to Saul. Here's something, listen, that I thought he probably thinks I would never do. I would never do this. He's experiencing losses. He's having moral lapses. Finally, he starts to be disgusted with his current leader. Look at verse 8. Then Abner became angry at the words of Ishbosheth and said, am I a dog? Dog's head that belongs to Judah? Today I show loyalty to the house of Saul, your father, and to his brothers and to his friends, and have not delivered you to the hand of David. And you charge me today with fault concerning this woman. May God do so to Abner, and more also, if I do not do for David as the Lord had sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah from Dan to Beersheba. And he could not answer Abner another word because he feared him, because Ishbosheth was a little wimpo. But anyways, verse 12. Then Abner said to the messengers on his behalf to David, saying, whose is the land? Saying also, make your covenant with me, and indeed my hand shall be with you and bring all of Israel to you. And David said, good, I will make a covenant with you. And one thing I require of you, you shall not see my face until you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face. And David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, saying, give me my wife, Michal, whom I betrothed to myself for 100 foreskins of the Philistines. And Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband, from Paltiel, the son of Laish. And her husband went along with her to Benjamin, weeping behind her. And so Abner said to him, go return. And then he returned. Don't get too sad for Bethiel here. Well, this is mean of David. He's taking him from her husband. This was David's wife, Michal. He was the one that was first married to her. This guy knew what was happening when Saul gave him his daughter instead of David. It was punishment to David. And what's this guy doing when he's taking away his wife? He's walking behind her going, what would you men do if someone broke into your house and took your wife? I wouldn't be alive when the story was over. That's what would happen. That's what would happen. Because again, I know Abner could take this guy down, but that's how the story would end. I wouldn't walk behind Christy going, and then just go, too bad, and go home. So I have very little respect for this guy. But anyways, verse 17. And Abner had communicated with the elders of Israel, saying, in times past, you were seeking for David to be king over you. Then do it, for the Lord has spoken of David. See, he knew. The Lord has spoken of David, saying, by my hand, my servant David, I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and the hand of their enemies. And Abner also spoke in the hearing of Benjamin. And Abner also went to speak in the hearing of David in Hebron, all that seemed good to Israel, the whole house of Benjamin. So Abner took 20 men with him and came to David in Hebron. And David made a feast for Abner and those men who were with him. And Abner said to David, I will arise and go and gather all Israel to my Lord the king. And they will make a covenant with you, and that you may reign over all that your heart desires. So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. And at that moment, the servants of David and Joab came from a raid and brought much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David in Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. peace. And when Joab and all the troops that were with him had come, they told Joab, saying, Abner, the son of Ner, came to the king, and he sent him away, and he has gone in peace. And Joab came to the king and said, what have you done? Look, Abner came to you. Why is it that you sent him away? He's already gone? Surely you realize that Abner, the son of Ner, came to deceive you, to know you're going out and you're coming in, and to know all that you were doing. And when Joab had gone from David's presence, he sent messengers after Abner and brought him back from the well of Sirah, but David didn't know it. And when Abner had returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside to the gate to speak to him privately, and there stabbed him in the stomach. So he died for the blood of Asahel, his brother. Afterwards, when David heard it, my kingdom and I are guiltless before the Lord forever. The blood of Abner, the son of Ner, let it rest on the head of Joab and on all his father's house, that there never fail to be the house of Joab one who has a discharge or a leper, one who leans on a staff or falls by the sword, who lacks bread. And David goes on for the rest of the chapter to weep and mourn over Abner. I focus on this story of Abner going from fighting against David to following David, because I think it parallels so greatly what happened in many of our lives, or maybe needs to happen in your life, where you stop fighting against the Son of David, Jesus Christ, and start following him with all of your heart, all of your soul, and all of your mind. Maybe you can remember when you were fighting against David, the Son of David, Jesus, in your life. Why was it? You had your reasons. For some of you, like Abner, it was a family reason. If I give my life to Christ, what will my dad think? He's so intellectual. He's such an evolutionist. If I give my life to Christ, what will my family think about me? And for you, it was a family reason. I don't know how I would show my face at Christmas anymore. Maybe for you, it wasn't just a family reason. It was a financial reason. You thought to yourself, if I give my life to the Lord, what will my coworkers think? Man, I won't do the things I used to do. I won't talk about the things I used to talk about. And I will just get ostracized. This won't work. And because of these concerns, you fought against Jesus, wooing you, trying to get you to follow him. But what happened? Same thing that happened to Abner. You started experiencing losses, things that used to go well for you that didn't anymore. What was that? God was trying to get your attention. If you can fight against God and nothing happens, that's when you need to worry. But for most of us, we knew we were in a battle and we knew we were losing. We would experience losses and we would experience moral failings. I mean, we had a standard even before we knew the Lord. And yet we found ourselves doing things we thought we would never do. Finally, like Abner, we start to lose faith in our leader, the world, the flesh, the devil. Those are horrible masters, and eventually we begin to see it. This King Ishbosheth, you know what his name means? His name means shameful man. And as we just read his story, and we'll close with chapter 4 in just a second, you'll see that it's true. This guy is just a shameful man, just like the flesh is, just like the devil is, just like our enemies are. Abner, when he sees this, he stops fighting the Son of David. He starts following David. Hold on, Jason. Your illustration breaks down. Because Abner is killed in the end. Sure he was. I know that. I didn't say once you start following Jesus, all your problems go away. No way. There are wicked people in the church, just like there are wicked people in the world. And I don't know about you, but we get stabbed in the back and people hurt us, just like Abner was hurt. And you know what, though? I bet when Abner stepped into eternity, he didn't regret one second following after David. I'm sure he had many regrets of fighting David for years, but I bet he had no regrets of the time, short time, but the short time he followed David. And I'm telling you, precious men and women, you may have people hurt you in the church. It may be difficult to follow Jesus at times, but when you step into eternity, you will not regret a thing about following Jesus. You will regret fighting him for so long in your life, but not a thing about following him. Abner is killed. Joab will eventually pay for that sin. But David again reacts with class and the defeat of his enemies. He mourns for Abner. And again, I believe it just spoke volumes to the nation of Israel. I mean, how do you think they would have reacted if they would have heard that David spit on Abner's head? Or David spit on Saul's head? He was their king. He was their general. No, David behaved with a godly heart, and the hearts of the people slowly turned. We see the final obstacle removed in chapter 4. I'm just going to read it. We'll make one comment, and we'll be done. When Saul's son heard that Abner had died in Hebron, he lost heart because he just a little wimpo. And all Israel was troubled. And Saul's son had two men who were captains of the troops. One's name was Banana. And the name of the other was Rechab. And the sons of Rimmon, the Beerothite, of the children of Benjamin, for Beeroth was part of Benjamin, because you need to know that. Anyways, verse 4. And Jonathan, Saul's son, had a son who was lame in his feet. He was 5 years old when he heard the news of Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel, and his nurse took him up and fled. And it happened, as she made haste to flee, that he fell and became lame, and his name was Mephibosheth. And we'll meet him next week. Great, great lessons from him. We'll get to that next week. Verse 5. Then the sons of Rimmon, the Beerothite, Rechab and Benah there, came out and came at about the heat of the day to the house of Ishbosheth. And what was he doing? He was lying on his bed at noon. Just caution, teenagers, caution. Bad stuff happens when you're lying in your bed at noon. It does for Ishbosheth. Verse 6. And they came there all the way into the house as though they get the wheat, and they stabbed him in the stomach. And Rechab and Benaiah, his brother, escaped. And when they had came to the house, he was lying in his bed in his bedroom. They struck him and killed him and beheaded him and took his head and were all at night and escaped through the plains. And what'd they do? Verse 8. They brought his head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron and said to the king, because no one learns, here is the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life. And the Lord has avenged my lord, the king, this day of Saul and his descendants. And David answered Rechab and Benaiah, his brother, the sons of Rimmon, the Beerothite, and said to them, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all adversity, when someone told me, saying, look, Saul is dead, thinking to have brought good news, I arrested him and had him executed at Ziklag. And the one who thought I would give him a reward for his news, how much more when wicked men have killed a righteous person in his own house on his bed? Therefore, shall I now require his blood at your hand and remove you from the earth? So David commanded his young men, and they executed them and cut off their hands and their feet and hung them by the pool in Hebron. That made swimming kind of tough that day. But they took off the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in the tomb of Abner in Hebron. Ishbosheth was not a great leader. I mean, he is not in battle with his dad and brothers when they die. And he was old enough. He was 30-some years. He was my age. He could have totally gone to war to help his dad and brothers. But this guy is the kind of guy that just lays in his bed until noon. That's the kind of guy Ishbosheth is. And because of that, these guys sneak in and they kill him in his bed. But just like the Amalekite, just like Joab or killed Abner, these guys come to David thinking he's going to reward them from killing the king, but that's not what happened. David had those men executed just like he had done with Saul's killer, and as eventually he'll do with Joab at the end of the story. We'll get to that a few weeks from now. He doesn't rejoice over the death of his enemies. He mourns. He realizes this guy was somebody's child, somebody's husband, somebody's king, someone's general, and David mourns. And listen, as he does, the heart of the people turn to David. I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was the time that David had spent with the Philistines. I don't know if it was the way that Saul portrayed David to the nation of Israel, or just the acts of Abner's rebellion after Saul's death. For whatever reason, we're not told, the nation of Israel was not ready for David to be their king at the death of Saul. And if David would have run in and just took the throne, I believe his story would have been much different than what we're going to read next week. The first 15 years of David's rule are as good as any king that has ever lived. Victory where they had never had victory before. Oh, you need to be with us this weekend and next Wednesday night. But it came as David waited on the Lord for his perfect work. I say that to you because I know humans. I am one. Surprising to some of you, but I am. We don't like to wait, do we? We don't like to wait for the promises of God. But I just want to close by reading you what David writes in Psalm 37, this man who learned how to wait. This psalm has encouraged my heart so many times, and I pray the same thing would happen in your heart. Let's go ahead and have the worship team come back up while I'm reading this. Don't worry. This is in the New Living Translation, by the way. Don't worry about the wicked, or envy those who do wrong, For like grass, they will soon fade away. Like spring flowers, they will soon wither. Trust in the Lord and do good. Then you will live safely in the land and prosper. Take delight in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Commit everything you do to the Lord. Trust him, and he will help you. He will make your innocence radiate like the dawn, and the justice of your cause will shine like the noonday sun. Be still in the presence of the Lord and wait patiently for him to act. Do not worry about evil people who prosper, fret about their wicked schemes. Stop being angry. Turn from your rage. Do not lose your temper, or it only leads to harm. For the wicked will be destroyed, but those who trust in the Lord, they will possess the land. Soon the wicked will disappear. Though you look for them, they'll be gone. The lowly will possess the land and will live in peace and prosperity. The wicked plot against the godly. They snarl at them in defiance. But the Lord just laughs, for he sees their day of judgment coming. The wicked draw their swords and string their bows to kill the poor and oppressed, to slaughter those who do right. But their swords will stab their own hearts, and their bows will be broken. For it is better to be godly and have little than to be evil and rich. For the strength of the wicked will be shattered, but the Lord will take care of the godly. Day by day, the Lord will care for the innocent and will receive as an inheritance that which lasts forever. They will not be disgraced in hard times, even in famine. They will have more than enough, but the wicked will die. The Lord's enemies are like flowers in a field. They will soon disappear like smoke. David says, turn from evil and do good, and you will live in the land forever. For the Lord loves justice, and he will never abandon the godly. David wrote that. David, who knew what it was to trust in the Lord and wait patiently from him, he later writes, you do it, precious men and women of the Lord. Oh, but the godly look like don't worry about it. You keep serving Jesus. You keep plugging ahead. You keep doing what God is calling you to do. And someday, just like David, that will be your testimony. The Lord is good. It looked bad. It looked like it wasn't going to come to pass. But God is good to those that know him and love him. Amen.